got to, looking at time, I got to head off. How about we continue this at some other time? Okay. And 73, WQTDD, KB2TRW.
Then I'll tell you next time what it's like to operate 20 meters and 10 meters from that end of the world. Oh, my Lord. Anyway. All right. Well, 73, and have a great one. And it's been fun, Kai. And thanks for sharing. And I'll keep that meeting on the 20th in mind. And I'm hoping Steve Leonardi sends that email out. But I don't know where. He's a ham as well, our district director. Anyway, Godspeed and enjoy. TRW,
K2RIW.
Dr. Dick, how are you?
Dr. Doy Gordon. Hey, I'm hearing a little bit of delay between the input and the output of this machine. You chimed in, I guess it was last Sunday or the Sunday before, on the subject of effective capture area of a dipole antenna. I don't think very many books express the real capture area of a dipole, so quite a few people are slightly amused by it when they hear it. How back to you.
Okay, I got to confess, I was playing chill. Because if you recall, I've asked you that question on several prior occasions until it finally got into my head. And what I wanted you to do is I wanted you to kind of make that point as well, because of the topic you were covering at the time.
Oh, so you were playing straight man, and I didn't even have to pay for that service.
That's right, that's right. I was out and about doing errands and moving people around, I forget what I was doing, and you know, it's good to make that point from time to time. You hit it with just the right amount of depth so that people will get the point without having to worry about all of the science behind it, because they don't really need to know, nor will they probably care. But they need to know that that's what's operative in the real world.
The real hard one to believe is that the effective capture area of an 80-meter dipole has almost no change as you physically shrink the dipole by large ratios and reestablish resonance. As long as what you're doing is made out of lossless materials, it keeps the exact same area within half a dB. That's a hard one for many people to accept. Sounds like you've already accepted it. K2RIW.
Yeah, I mean, I totally get it. I mean, it's an odd principle, but you know what finally made it real? When I was looking at things like fractals, and before that, you know, various folded element arrays of various kinds and things like that, I finally said, oh, now I get it.
There's an amazing number of people out there who think that a fractal is going to suddenly give them super gain in the same size or a less size on the same frequency. Fractals have got their purpose, but in the direct approach of them, they don't supply any super gain. A lot of people think they do.
Well, they're not going to unless you get those elemental components, you know, spaced, you know, appropriately, or cobbled together appropriately, depending on whether you're doing a fractal Yagi, fractal quad, fractal delta, or fractal collinear, with or without a reflector. You know, I mean, on and on and on.
Yeah, the bottom line is you don't get extra directivity. That's where the gain comes from. Without investing in real estate. It's either going to be real estate of a boom, because you've got multiple elements of a Yagi-like structure, or it's going to be real estate of multiple collinear elements, or it's going to be real estate of multiple elements like a phased array. You got to invest in real estate to make directivity, and if you don't have directivity, you probably don't have gain. And you got to be careful. Even if you've got directivity, you might not have gain. KTRIW.
Well, yeah, you know, I hate to model this stupidly, but you know, there are whether I left out the third case of the face to race. Thank you for adding that to my head. I was thinking collinear phasing as opposed to, I just kind of forgot the what I'll call the standard, you know, phased elements that are common, you know, have feeding that are in phase or out of phase, in the case of maybe to know what you're trying to do. But anyway, you need to invest in real estate. You got to put, you know, geographically disperse these elements. That's the part that you can't compromise on. You compromise on the elemental length for a given, should we say, resonance, albeit with a high Q. But what you can compromise on is making the signal go, you know, in one direction or another, preferably with the equivalent gain around it. Kind of hard for people to wrap their brains around. But, why not? Anyway, a while back I was playing with dipoles. On the roof of my truck, I inadvertently found 10 meters that when you put a 10-meter dipole on top of a 20-odd-foot truck that has a steel grid mesh roof rack from front to back bumper that's, maybe in a 0.15 wavelengths or so underneath it, that you start to get some really weird characteristics in the vertical plane. Signals get thrown up instead of out.
Yeah, I think you're saying that you're stringing a dipole from the front bumper to the back bumper on 10 meters with a dipole a very short distance in wavelengths above the roof of the truck, assuming the roof of the truck is metallic. At first I would think that's a Nevis antenna, but then again, I think there are ways you could force the vehicle itself into a kind of partial resonance. There's not a big enough ground plane under it to make it a pure Nevis. By the way, Gordon, I think your audio is quite a bit lower in volume than you'd like it to be. I believe you're dissipating, you're deviating about 1 kilohertz with your audio. W2TTT, K2RIW.
Oh, isn't that just lovely to think about? Okay. Well, number one, I'm tired, so I'm kind of speaking quietly. But number two, I need to crack the radio open. Maybe I'll do that in a couple of minutes. Something else to do, what the heck? And thank you for reminding me about that, Dick. I've been reminded of that before, and I really have to make a point of speaking up and only partially doing that even now. So there's probably, you know, some cranking work to do. There's a pod inside this DR510 that I can probably easily identify and tweak to get up the, bring up some gain. But yeah, so what I used to have, I don't know if you ever saw it, but I still drive an E350 XLT, so that's the 15-passenger van. And from the front bumper to the rear bumper, I had a mesh steel deck. So it kind of looked like the wheeled version of the USS Langley, you know, a cruiser hull with a flight deck on top. This was a truck with a flight deck on top. And it was full mesh, and I had... I'd say about 5 feet in the air, 4.5 feet in the air, above the rack deck. I had a dipole, 10-meter dipole, that was from the front bumper to the back bumper, but it was 5 feet above the roof rack. And so, it had some interesting characteristics. When there were, you know, satellites to be had, I could. 10 meters, I could hear them very well. there was some Nevis antenna characteristics, but there were also other things too. I noticed that when there was aurora on 6 meters, I would hear some aurora on 10 as well, much better in the vehicle than sometimes I would with my regular 10-meter dipole in the house.
Yeah, I heard 10 meters, I heard 2 meters, I'm not quite sure now. You've got a flight deck on top of the truck. 5 feet above the flight deck, you've got a dipole on some frequency I don't know about. And I'm trying to picture 5 feet above a deck, and the deck is above the roof of the truck. How did you suspend that? And if you drove on a residential street that had low-hanging branches, do the branches sometimes strike that antenna? Over to you, Gordon, K2LIW.
Yeah, absolutely. I got that. They would hit things all the time. They still do. Okay, so let's see. Let's try to put this in perspective. From the rear bumper to the front bumper, with two risers coming off the bumper to hold the front of the rack, I had a rectangular deck that was made of grid mesh and 1 inch by 2 inch steel tubing, rectangular steel tubing that was welded all together. And that deck was my roof rack. I would put radio stuff there, I put scout stuff there, whatever I had to do. This was on 10 meters. So we did that, and what I did was on the front part of the deck and the rear part of the deck, I took a piece of PVC and suspended a dipole. Actually, I put in the middle a piece of PVC as well to hold the feed point up. I just had myself a balanced, through a balance, a one-to-one balance. I basically stuck a 10-meter dipole.
Okay, if the 10-meter dipole is above the mesh by 5 feet, and 10 meters is 32-foot wavelength, that's a very small fraction of a wavelength, and so my guess is you had to do a little bit of extra work to impedance match that. In fact, even making the resistive component right would be a little bit of an effort. Just adjusting the lens is only going to make the reactive component right, and this horizontally polarized dipole parallel to the mesh deck. When you talk to terrestrial stations on 10 meters, if the truck was in a very large parking lot and you drove in circles while talking to somebody on 10 meters, I presume you saw some significant pattern there. Is that true, Gordon? K2LIW?
Yeah, absolutely. But what I also noticed was that if people were in the far field during an opening, it was more of a crapshoot as to what was going on. And in fact, it seemed to work really, really well. And also for listening on 28 megahertz or 29 megahertz for satellites, the satellites were pretty strong.
Yeah, I guess I wasn't as familiar with 28 megs being often used on the satellites. I thought most of them were 2 meters, 440 and above, 432 and above. Also, I noticed that your current rig, you talk loud enough, I do hear the speech compressor starting to work, and even when you talk loud enough to use the speech compressor, I think the deviation is a little bit lower than you'd like. I guess you're saying you may have had a report of someone else saying something similar to that, K2LIW.
Yeah, unfortunately I use this radio very intermittently, and it is now my primary, quickie 2-meter 440, actually one of several 2-meter 440 radios I have in the shack, but the others are not hooked up right now. Need to correct that, but I am now clearing the way so as to be able to get to the radio and perform the necessary modulation change. Let me do this. Let me switch microphones just on the off chance it's a microphone problem.
And while you're switching microphones, I'll mention to you that I think that microphone and or rig has a very rapid fall off on the low end. I'm going to make a rough guess that below 800 hertz, it's falling off very fast. There's absolutely no bass to your voice. The good news is that with a speech clipper and no bass, you do have some punch, but it doesn't have the fidelity of a good telephone, if you know what I mean. Over to you, Warden, KQRIW.
Well, that microphone didn't key up anything at all, so clearly that microphone has issues. Alright, I'm going to spin up a radio on the input here. Let me see here. Hello, 1212. Yeah, there's not a lot of low end to that. Even on the handy talk, you can hear that. It just doesn't sound very rich. It sounds very, very high. Yeah, the deviation is low. How about that?
Out of curiosity, how did you determine that the deviation is low?
Because compared to what I had if I listened to you on the repeater output versus myself on the repeater input, there was a perceptible difference in amplitude.
Understand. And I'm not sure I'm running the right amount of deviation. I'm just running the amount that was built into a Kenwood 711 at the factory. I don't think I've ever touched it. And I think the knob on the front panel, yeah, the volume control knob, mic gain, operates in the sideband mode, but in the FM mode, many rigs, mic gain has no effect in the FM mode. So I'm set with that deviation. I've got the speech processor on this rig turned on. If I turn off the speech processor, you can see that I sound a lot more muffled. So I always run the nets in this mode. Have you ever run a net in the full duplex mode where with earphones you can hear what's coming out of the machine? You guys don't have the problem over there in Bergen, but on Long Island, there's a significant number of times where what you're saying doesn't come through, and by listening to yourself coming back out, you know what words to repeat. You know when to increase power because somebody is running mobile on the same frequency at the same time. There's a lot of good information that happens when you run full duplex and you're running a net. I'm amazed how few people do that. W2TTT, K2RIW.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, I actually do that. I haven't done it recently. What you're hearing is my handy talking in the background. I've spun it up to the output. I'm close enough to the repeater so I can actually run low power in the shack and have a handy talkie right here and have a minimal hiss on the handy talkie with the whip sitting on the desk. It is kind of interesting. But, one thing I will say, I ran this whole net and the post-net conversation in high power, and this radio is screaming hot.
Yep, I don't think you had to do that. Yeah, the next step of improvement with that handy-talkie now is to plug earphones into the output of the handy-talkie and disconnect that speaker. That way you won't get feedback.
Oh, no, what I'm saying is I've done this with real radios before. I say real radios, meaning not the handy-talkie. Way back when, I used to run the net. Let me close talk this, that's better. I used to run the net with a pair of Icon 746 Pros, Omni on the transmit, and operating Simplex on the input, and the other radio operating listening to repeater on the output. And I ran both sets of audio into my headset so I could balance out who was on the input, who was out. I could decide whether I want to listen to the repeater out or just the repeater in or both. And, it was very, very helpful.
Do you have the ability to unplug the current radio, plug the output connector of the handy talkie into that radio, and or just transmit with a handy talkie to the repeater? Is there a way that I can hear the handy talkie coming through the repeater Over to you, Gordon.
CEIR.
What?
Yeah, I presume Gordon is changing antennas on Handy Talkie versus Rick. Hi, Dick. This is Howie, K2EIR, formerly WB2PUI. And my last communication with you, I sent you some articles on prostate technique to reverse BPH. I don't know if you remember that.
W2TTT, this is my Handy Talkie. I just had the wrong tone set.
Boy, that is a lot nicer audio. Howie, yes, thank you for that information. As I remember, I heard you on, had a little trouble getting back to you in time before you went away. Howie, comment on Gordon's audio on the new rig. K2EIR, K2LAW in the group.
It is much nicer. That really sums it up, Gordon. It's fuller, clearer, cleaner. It definitely is easier to listen to. This is not my regular rig, and so I don't have the nice speaker, so I'm a little bit limited in my critique.
Well, here's a Handy Talkie for now, since I've got screws coming off the DR510 mobile radio. And besides, the 510 is so hot I can't hold the radio.
Gordon, I mean Howie, since you and I last talked, I think the pronouncement was made that physicians no longer recommend that people take a PSA test, because the PSA test, I guess, has a reasonably high misdetection rate and false alarm rate. I think that all occurred since you and I last talked. K2EIR, K2LIW.
Roger, Dick. That's true. However, I also went. Greenwich Hospital has a prostate cancer support group, and I've been there a few times. They had a pathologist come in as a guest speaker, and he had a fascinating presentation. I wish they would do like some of the ham clubs and circulate these things as PDFs or whatever, or at least circulate it afterwards so that you could keep the notes. But the pathologist talked about a few other tests that they can do in combination. And when they do that, the predictability apparently approaches 70%, 70% accuracy or whatever. So I guess it's better, but I was really curious if you remember, and I know sometimes you have some memory problems, whether, you know, what your reaction was to that article about actually these Israeli doctors can reverse BPH, and they think it may be the cause of cancer as well, so that if you have this procedure, it's sort of like having circumcision as a preventative, that if you have this procedure for BPH, you might not get prostate cancer as well, you know, as a side benefit.
Because I'm forgetful, and you're absolutely right, what approximately was the procedure to reverse BPH? Was it nutrition? Or what was it? Back to you, Howie.
Hey, this is K2EIR. Bear with us, Gordon. This doctor, and by the way, he was trained first as an engineer, so he also had a background in fluid mechanics, and he got into this business, so to speak, after his medical degree because he was looking at fertility problems, which is kind of important in Israel. So basically he found that there are varicose veins in the scrotum. And one-way valves, very similar to, you know, anywhere else in the body, were failing. And this provided a direct path from the scrotum to the prostate, or a slightly indirect path, where large amounts of testosterone would go to the prostate and flood the prostate. And this caused the enlargement, which causes DPH, and also the flood of testosterone is hypothesized to cause cancer. And his cure was to use a sclerosant, just like they do in varicose veins in the legs, in some form of microsurgery. And again, it's like a, let me let this reset. It's some former radiologist does this, and they basically close off those varicose veins so the testosterone doesn't flow any longer from the scrotum to the prostate. And by the way, this large diversion also accounts for why it's the sort of the paradox that men have had a low testosterone level in the blood serum while still having, you know, these symptoms which they thought would be caused, you know, cancer would be caused by overstimulation of testosterone. So he answered both kinds of questions, and basically the proof of the pudding is he says he's done this technique the last time I checked on 70 men, and you know, they all had marked improvement. The prostate shrank, the nocturia went away, et cetera, et cetera.
Will you tune TTT just louder?
I think you're back to the original rig. I think it's a little bit louder, but it still has that high-pitched audio work. Gordon, go ahead.
Okay, here's more. Let's see, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. I've just spun VR3 every which way from Sunday. It's now what I think is the max. How does it sound now?
I think the volume is about right, but I don't think the fidelity is what you would like. Let's see what Howie thinks. Go ahead, Howie.
I think that's very accurate, Dick. Once again, I'm sorry that with this rig that I'm using tonight, it isn't the audio that I'm used to, so I can't be sure that I'm giving the best critique. But, you know, I might not hear subtle differences, but what Dick says is exactly how I would describe it.
Okay. I just found two other... Well, let's see. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. All right. This is what I perceive to be the maximum audio. This is what I perceive with the maximum deviation. So hopefully... This is what you got, and let me just reduce the other audio. I'm going to put them both at minimum real quick and just see if that makes a difference. I'm cranking down the audio first. Okay, now the audio is at the minimum. Now I'm going to add deviation at the minimum. Now, both audio and deviation are at the minimum. I'm going to turn them back where I had them at the max. There's deviation max. There's mic gain max. Okay, your thoughts, gentlemen?
Nor 2 dB change, hardly anything.
I heard the audio going up and down a little bit as you changed the audio gain control. As you changed the deviation control, I didn't hear anything happening. And too bad you don't have any other mic. I'm going to make a rough guess that the mic is what's lacking in the low-frequency components. Back to you, Gordon.
Well, that could be, but, you know, my question, I guess my fear is, you know, am I too low, or is my audio still low?
I think your audio volume now is about right. The next thing to work on is the fidelity. And if you had a microphone that had some more low-frequency notes, although the current volume is correct, you add the low-frequency notes, and the current setting of that rig might be now a little bit over-deviating. But the until we get that new mic there, we don't know for sure. Back to you, Gordon.
Okay, well, here's the Elenco, and I'll switch over to the HT again.
And here's my Here's my handy-talkie W2TTT, and I'll go back to the Elenco.
This is the Elenco W2TTT.
Boy, that handy-talkie sounds like you. The Elenco sounds like a robot synthesized speech. I'm exaggerating a little bit.
A tin can.
No, I get it. Yeah, this is the HT. HT is really, you know, it's a Kenwood HT, like everything else Kenwood. They just have such wonderful audio. You know, they spoil the hell out of you. it broke my heart for the years that I was running ICOM gear only. I now have a Flex 5000 and an IC7000, which I'm not using in the shack. I probably should make the Go kit ready to go, but usable in the shack. But anyway, this is kind of a nice setup, I must confess. And it's nice living in reasonable proximity to the repeater. I can use an aftermarket rubber duck and be so good.
From what you were saying, Howie, the original pathways for the fluids had valves. As a person ages, those valves fail, and testosterone goes in places where too much testosterone goes in places where it doesn't belong. The nicest cure would be to reestablish those valves. I have the impression that the procedure you're describing literally cuts off those pathways. I'm amazed that that's not a little bit too extreme, that now no flow occurs as opposed to the proper flow in the proper direction. Over to you, Howie, K2LIW.
This is K2EIR. Well, you know, it's been a while since I read the articles, but I did send at least one of them to you, and I don't know if you could find it. It was called a reversal of BPH or something like that, and the main doctor, there were two authors, was Dr. Gott, G-A-T. And if you send me an email, and it's my call at arrl.net, if you send me an email, if you want it again, or even tell me, although I may not be able to do it for a few days, I will send it to you again if you'd like to read it. But it was very detailed and very logical and very clear, you know, that even without a biological background, without a medical background, I was able to read it and understand it fairly well. What I mean is the guy was really lucid. How's that, Dick?
Yeah, I'm looking in my place where I normally file medical information, and if you sent it to me as an email, why in the world didn't I put it there? My email address is my call letters at arrl.net. So somewhat easy to remember. If you remember the call letters of the guy who tries to run the TechNet, you may have heard that I was shocked recently to find that I've been running the TechNet for 29 years. The total number of hours of TechNet with K2LIW is identical to the total number of hours that Johnny Carson was on The Tonight Show in his 30 years of doing it. And I think it constitutes something like 2% of my life has been spent on the TechNet. I've heard of dedication, but I suspect this is obsessive. Over to you, Howie, K2LIW.
I told you 5 years ago you were a role model.
Dick, have you ever heard the expression, nobody on his deathbed says, I wish I spent more time at the office?
Yeah. So, I should say, gee, I spent too much time on the TechNet and not enough time with the family. I could easily say that. The TechNet did give me one benefit. Once I opened my consulting business, my RF consulting business, there are people who know who I am, and I get some business from that. In fact, my best client that has given me a ton of money found me by that procedure. So, in some respects, it paid off. Had I not found that client, I might not have had the cash flow to allow me to stay in this expensive area with this house alongside of this Rhone 55 tower. The Rhone 55 tower is my raison d'etre. And the house alongside of it, the real purpose of the house, Howie, is to keep the rain off my equipment. K2EIR, K2LIW.
What does your wife say about that? Sorry about that. What does your wife say about that?
My wife's also a ham. Not quite as crazy as I am, but she also is one. Go ahead, Howie.
Well, I'm feeling guilty again about keeping this from Gordon. Listen, I told Gordon 40 minutes ago I have to get up early, and I was signing off, but I really wanted to get in there. It was fascinating to listen to you. Gordon and I talked actually a few sessions back about fractal antennas, and I discovered some of the things on the net. There was a 73 magazine of a 10-meter fractal quad. I don't know what you guys have discussed. So I was intrigued to hear you two talking about this and the capture area, because the other antenna that, how we got into that thing is Gordon and I started, there was a linear-loaded, shortened 40-meter antenna that I intend to, I built once and gave away to a guy with a, who needed a stealth antenna, and we put it under his deck in his condominium development. And now I want to build one. I have 20-foot telescoping masts, and I want to build this for portable operation. Try to make a Y out of it on top of the poles, military surplus poles that I go portable with. Anyway, that's why I was fascinated, but I am going to leave. I'm going to go to my computer, though, and see if I can find the article quickly and email it to you again so that you can read it. And I'm going to wish both of you a good night. You're both in each other's good company, and 73. So let me turn to Gordon, because he hasn't had it enough, and I'm going to run to the computer, so you can leave me out of it. I won't hear it. 73, guys. W2TTT, K2RIW, here's K2EIR.
Bye-bye, Howie, and thank you.
Night, Howie. Take care. Good hearing you again. Look forward to working you tomorrow when you're on your school runs, which I guess are going to end soon, so you'll be a little more intermittent in the summer. I'll just say this. You need not apologize. My audio reports can wait behind anybody's, shall we say, issues related to PSA tests and the like. What self-respecting guy over 50 is going to get in the way of that conversation if it needs to happen for someone else's benefit or possibly their own? Hi. Anyway, mercifully, mine's okay for now. But anyway, I'm a spring chicken at 54, so we'll see what happens in another 10 years. And, Dick, don't laugh too hard, but because of papers I wrote in the digital, from the Computer Networking Conference, State of Oil Computer Networking Conference proceedings, and other activities related to packet radio, I attracted the attention of people at Bell Labs, and then later on when someone else unrelated to Labs asked me if I knew anybody there who could be a reference, should they want to place me there as a consultant, I gave a long list of names, and next thing you know, I'm not working with any of them or their organizations, but I did land a job over there, and I've been there for 25 years now, first as a consultant, and then for, I guess it'll be 18 years now. In September, it'll be 18 years as a regular employee. So, yeah, I get your point.
When you switch from consultant, which means you get no benefits, but a nice juicy salary, over to employee, where you get benefits, were you able to keep the same salary, Gordon?
Okay, it's a complicated picture, but here was the problem. Over the period of time that I was a consultant, was doing very, very well, had a very, very high compensation, billing rate from Bell Labs, and my consulting company commanded that for me, if you will. They in turn paid me a salary. Over time, my salary and benefits, which I got from the consulting company, yes, I got benefits, started to exceed what they were, the rate at which they were billing me. Forget their margin; it exceeded with their costs in every which way from Sunday. But they were kind of in a catch-22 because they had 50 other employees there, and my organization that I was working for in the labs made it abundantly clear that where I go, so go to the other 50,
as soon as their contracts run out, if not sooner. So they kind of had them over a barrel. Eventually, that consulting company released me from my obligation, and procurement or purchasing, I guess it was back in those days, placed me with a different consulting company that wanted me to be their loss leader, for lack of a better term. And that was fine. So when I finally became an employee, they, not realizing that I had benefits on top of my salary, yeah, they chopped me the nominal 30-odd percent plus benefits. In reality, that's what really happened. Well, not plus, but they chopped me 30-odd percent from my salary, thinking that I had to pay my own benefits, and whereas that was really not true. So it took me a few years to get back, but hold on, let me drop it. The problem was that I saw the writing on the wall that they were going to, over time, not pay my level of rate for anybody on the planet. And in point of fact, 25 years later, the dollar amount, forget the dollar value, the dollar amount that is typically billed is half of what I was billing 25 years ago at the labs.
Run that last sentence again. Something was half of something else. I didn't quite catch that one. Go ahead.
I was billing 25 years ago a figure, an hourly figure, that is double what they will pay as a max today.
Wow. Now, here's a question you might know that I don't know. If a person works as an engineer for a job shop, can't assume that the job shop is hiring him because he's got some kind of a skill that's in demand. The employer has to pay a premium to the job shop compared to the salary that the job shopper gets. Is that premium 20%, 25%, 30%? What is the typical premium that the job shopper, that the job shop charges the customer compared to the salary the job shopper gets? Is there a rough rule of thumb as to what that premium is? And I guess there's going to be more than one premium depending on whether or not the job shop is supplying benefits to the job shopper. W2GTG, K2RIW.
Yeah, I'm going to throw a dart at the wall and say if there's no benefits, it's somewhere between 15 and 25%.
No benefits, 15 to 25%. And I could make some guesses as to what it would be with benefits. I should know this. I should have checked on it. But in my particular case, I was working for, as a consultant, for a good-sized company. And on about the second or third year, where I'm working for them every single day, the legal beagles of the company suddenly got alarmed that the IRS is going to say, hey, you declare this a consultant, a temporary employee, but he shows up every day. That is an employee. They were so scared that the IRS would make that declaration, charge them some kind of a penalty, that they forced me to start operating with a job shop as opposed to a direct consultant. And part of that was complicated by the fact that I had not personally incorporated. Probably a dumb move on my part, but I wasn't incorporated. Over to you, K2RIW.
Yeah, W2TTT. Couple of things on that. What you're referring to after 3 years is what is referred to now as the Microsoft rule. And that's because some putts who worked for Microsoft for a bunch of years, probably like me or you, like 5 years, 7 years, whatever, said, oh, you owe me all this other stuff because, in fact, I'm a de facto statutory employee and not a consultant or contract employee. And so the quid pro quo was that, yeah, while the guy lost his case, he lost his case because the IRS had not made such a declaration. So they were the federal courts directed that the IRS had to come up with a policy as to what that is. And the magic answer is three years. Some use 30 months because every 3 years they want you back. But whatever. The bottom line is that that is called the Microsoft rule. It's because some idiot did that. I was so fortunate at Bell Labs because of the nature of the work I was doing. It kind of varied a little bit. I was building systems, doing network management, doing protocols on how to do that, pushing the envelope on how those protocols should work, how to build them, how to define them, you know, all sorts of, you know, odd syntax and transfer syntaxes and the like, structured database kind of transfer syntaxes, things that, you know, if you look at modern HTML and Java and all this other happy nonsense, you know, we'd say, we do this already, but, you know, 25 years ago we didn't. So in any case, bottom line is that they took very good care of me. If they were having budget problems on a project that I was associated with, they would move me to another project on a Monday or Tuesday, tell me to work, to give me new materials for the project I would be working on going forward, and tell me, go home and read this the rest of the week. We'll put, you're billable. Just go read this at home. Don't bother coming in. And on Friday, about 9 o'clock in the morning, my phone would light up with all my colleagues who were consultants who were being laid off. I had no clue. This happened several times before I figured it out.
Wow, that must make you feel funny. Okay, 3 years because of the Microsoft rule. But now, what does that 3 years mean? If the person works 2 days a week on the average week, and he's doing that continuously for three years, does the rule come into play? In my case, I was working half day every single day for three solid years, and I really got scared. But if you only work occasionally over a three-year period, you can see this, in my mind, a gray zone. How do they differentiate that gray zone, Gordon, KQLIW?
You know, I don't know. That's a good question. I mean, never to second guess the IRS on anything, but I would think that, you know, if you're home or you're only doing a few hours a week, you know, if you're less than 20 hours, if you're a 19 and a half hour employee, then it's probably easy. If you're over 20 hours, then I think it's harder to separate yourself from that Microsoft rule. Now, by going to the job shop, I'm surprised that allows you to work, because all my colleagues now who are consultants go through a job shop of one form or another. As a consequence of that, we do have two kinds of things. We have individual contracts that are going to run through the job shop. We also have project contracts. Project contracts may allow for wiggle room, even if you're there 40 hours or more a week, because you're not being hired. The company is being hired to render a set of deliverables. You just happen to work for that company.
Sounds like you've got a real good relationship with Bell Labs. Homedale, Murray Hill, and I can't think of the name of the third one. Which one of the Bell Labs have you done the most work for?
Okay, cool. Keep in mind I'm an AT&T employee now, and I've been an AT&T employee since September 1st, 94. Is that right? Yeah, September 1st, 94. So that's 18 years this September. There was no room in my organization's office space in Homedale, so I was assigned to Red Hill, which, if you've been down the Garden State Parkway to go to Homedale, you get off at exit 114 and you turn right to head to Crawford's Corner Road, you make another right, you you're on Crawford's Corner Road and you come in the main entrance underneath the water tower that looks like a transistor. If you get off at Red Hill Road at 114 and don't make that right and just drive straight across the road, there was a rented or leased space that was lovingly referred to as Red Hill, and since it was on Red Hill Road, and that's where I worked. I also worked with people in Middletown, which at first was an American Bell facility when they had to have the arm's length R&D apart from the labs. And I never worked there in the American Bell time frame, but after Lucent was split off, I was sent off to First Bell Labs and then Lucent. In the second divestiture, I ended up with office space in Middletown. So, but I haven't had an office there in a dozen years or so. I actually am a full-time telecommuter working from the comfort of my ham shack.
Boy, life is tough. There's a third major facility way back in the dark ages of Bell Labs. Homedale, Murray Hill, and I keep thinking, forgetting the third one.
Piscataway.
Piscataway?
Well, there's others. There's also Whippany.
Whippany is the one I'm trying to think of. Can never think of that one. I think it's where Reed Fisher, W2CQH, worked. Wonder if you knew anything about Reed, and wonder if you know anything about his history. Over to you, Gordon.
Well, I know a little bit about Reed, but not as much as I'd probably like. I'm kind of curious who just jumped in there. Why don't we get that breaker in here first, W2TTT.
W2TTT, this is AJ4WD, Rachel.
Oh, hi, Rachel. Okay. Oh, we have Dick K2RAW and yours truly, W2TTT here. Well, let's see. A lot of people who are from Piscataway ended up in Middletown or East Brunswick, which was another facility. East Brunswick wasn't a labs facility as much as it was an AT&T R&D facility. It was where the AT&T corporate billing systems were written or defined. There was some of that going on in Piscataway. There was some network operations going on in Piscataway as well. In fact, until recently, there were still activities in Piscataway. But a lot of those people over the last 20 years have been moved to either up to Bedminster or down to Middletown. Sadly, with Alcatel buying Lucent, the Homedale facility is totally idle, about to be demolished, and only recently not in a total state of disrepair. I mean, there were trees growing up through the roads because Lucent hadn't paid any money to do any grounds maintenance because they let the whole place turn fallow. It was really, really sad. The other facility, Telegraph Hill, where Arno Penzias discovered the Big Bang, that's a national landmark, and they have to do at least, they have to at least cut the grass, but they don't have to paint the dish. They technically can let the dish and the assembly fall apart. They can't take it down. It makes me crazy. That's the cornucopia dish that was on a circular track that also could be elevated at 180 degree arc, because it was a cornucopia dish that was laid on its back as opposed to standing straight up like you would see on the old long lines microwave sites. Whippany was undersea systems. I think that's what Reed used to do. What they call the submarine systems. A lot of the SOSIS system was built there quietly and under a lot of black project work. And then Murray Hill was where all sorts of interesting things happened. It was also the Unix Labs, which spun off from Murray Hill and was in Short Hills for years. And my current VP, who's a former colleague of mine, that's where he was when I first came to the labs 25 years ago. Rachel, why don't you say something and hand it to Dick, AJ4WD, W2TTT.
I had the privilege of working at Bell Labs in Piscataway and then moved up to Whippany. And I think there was also a facility in Morristown referred to as the farm, because it was a campus right across from a farm. And I did a little bit of work in that that area as well. That goes back, as Gordon pointed out, quite a number of years ago. It seems like yesterday, but then I've been with UPS for 19 years, so it's been quite a while. But those were the heydays. Those were really a lot of fun, doing a lot of innovative stuff. I was doing, what do you call it, natural language and artificial intelligence and that kind of stuff. Over to you. I think Court said Rick.
Hey, yes, Rachel. My name is Dick. I'm K2 Romeo India Whiskey. Homedale, when I visited Homedale in the very early 70s, was a very plush place. The teacup piece of architecture out front, the building itself was, by my standards then, a really fancy building with a great big atrium that went up about four or five floors, with a great big tree in the middle of the atrium, as I remember. Very nice place. And off to one side of Homedale is where the Hughorn was, and also the 60-foot dish. And I guess they're called Telescope Hill, but my recollection is that Telescope Hill was really part of the property of Homedale. Do I have that incorrect, Gordon? Go ahead.
No, that's correct. It was a five-story atrium. There were five tiers, and the last row, the outside row, was the H aisle on each end. And then they expanded the building in, I'm just trying to think what years that was. I guess it was the late 70s. And they went out to H-I-J-K-L or O, I can't remember. But the building ended up being slightly more than a quarter mile long, and was rather impressive. The dining facilities there were outstanding. You could go to the cafeteria, but you could also go to the service dining room if you wanted to spend a few dollars. And you would actually get waitress service at lunchtime. It was so civilized. Oh, gosh. And a lot of the Bell Labs facilities, I mean, Red Hill didn't have a service dining room. It had a barely functional cafeteria. So we would often jump in the car and go to Homedale or Lincroft. Lincroft had a tiny little service dining room, but it was very, very pleasant. We enjoyed that one as well. I don't know. Did Whippany I know Murray Hall had a service dining room too that was lovely. I'm just remember, Rachel, did the Piscataway have a service dining room, or did Whippany?
Whippany did. Piscataway, it was interesting. It was a cafeteria, but it was run by the local restaurants. So each day, a different restaurant was coming in, and they had, what, five or six service stations. So you had, you know, five or six different sandwich shops, five or six different Chinese restaurants, five or six different whatevers. So each day it was, you know, a choice of five different stations from five different restaurants in the area. It was a very unique concept, very unique design, and really gave you a lot of flexibility. And on top of that, it was subsidized, so it was very affordable.
Yes, not no more, no more. We have ARA services. Oh, boy. They do a credible job, by the way, but, you know, it's not like the old days, but it's a lot better than a lot of other catering services. Good, Dick.
That beautiful Homedale building. How in the world can somebody take something that plush, that beautiful looking, and abandon it? Wild.
glad to hear that the Hoghorn, that Wilson, and why can't I think? Arno Penzias and Penzias Wilson? Okay. The guys who won the Nobel Prize for the Big Bang discovery of 2.4